I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson. In a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, B. Lund, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick, Galen, Arlen, Bo, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan, David, Gary, Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho, Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, journalist Yumna Patel of Mondo Weiss returns to discuss her latest documentary, On the Brink, Jenin's Rising Resistance, which takes a look at the aftermath of the uniquely deadly Israeli army raid on the Jenin refugee camp this past January. Additionally, the documentary focuses in particular on the rise of armed resistance amongst young Palestinians against the Israeli occupation. Yumna went so far as to interview actual resistance fighters, and she'll be telling us all about that and much more in the conversation to follow. Joining me as a special guest co-host on this edition of the show is Carl Barks of the West Bank Robbery Podcast. Carl was kind enough to make me aware of the documentary's recent release, and I decided to include him in the conversation. So with all that being said, let's get right to it with Yumna Patel on her documentary, On the Brink, Jenin's Rising Resistance. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that I always enjoy having on the program. She does some great documentary work for Mondo Weiss. Yumna Patel, she's here to talk with us about her latest documentary, On the Brink, Jenin's Rising Resistance, and also joining us is my friend Carl Barks from the West Bank Robbery Podcast. Yumna, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
So, Carl, I want to let you lead because you were the one that notified me that this documentary was out. Maybe you could give your initial thoughts on it and any questions you had for Yumna.
Yeah, your new documentary, Jenin on the Brink. That's correct. On the Brink, Jenin's Rising Resistance. I saw that and I was extremely impressed. Most documentaries that feature Palestinians, especially Palestinians engaged in any sort of resistance, generally interview like two main people. It's usually children crawling out of rubble and interviewing them at that moment, like a fighter, like immediately after, you know, they knock the guy out, or just like a screaming widow. And you didn't do any of that. You actually asked people what their thoughts were in a setting where they could reply, you know, they could take their time. And you actually interviewed people involved in resistance, and particularly the paramedic. I felt like that was a really good look at Palestinians that you don't normally talk to. How was the documentary? How'd you find these guys, basically?
Thanks. Thanks for your thoughts, your comments. It's always good to hear people's feedback and what they think about our work. So I'll give you a little bit of context and maybe the audience a little bit of context about this most recent documentary that we did. So on January 26th, the Israeli army went into the Jenin refugee camp and conducted a raid that lasted several hours in the morning. And in just the span of those few hours, they shot and killed 9 Palestinians. 2 of them were children, were minors. One of them was an elderly woman in her 60s. And the rest were young Palestinian men involved in the armed resistance in Jenin. A few days later, a 10th Palestinian succumbed to his wounds, also a fighter from that raid. So that raid was one of the deadliest single raids into the Jenin refugee camp in years, but also one of the deadliest, you know, single raids that we had seen across the West Bank in several years as well. And so it caused shockwaves across Palestine. It was this huge event. And so what we did was we decided, okay, we're going to go into the camp the day after following the raid and essentially just try to talk to as many people as we can and try to get the full picture. Like you said, oftentimes when the media, particularly the mainstream media, is covering Palestine, particularly instances of violence against Palestinian communities and also Palestinian resistance, particularly armed struggle, we don't actually hear from the people who are participating in that armed struggle, or we only see these sort of images of people in their most dire, destitute sort of moments right in the aftermath of these horrible events. And I mean, we did go in the day after, so I think a lot of people were still in shock, but we went in with the, not with the goal of capturing these sort of images that maybe you could crack up to trauma porn, you know, of people getting pulled out of the rubble and that sort of thing. We went in with the idea of really wanting to listen to people, to hear from them and to get the full story. Jenin, particularly the Jenin refugee camp, has been the symbol of armed struggle in Palestine, certainly for several decades, particularly since the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. But even most recently in the past few months and over the past year, we've seen this resurging resistance and a rise in armed struggle, particularly against, particularly amongst the younger Palestinian generation. We've seen a rise in that in the occupied West Bank. And a lot of that has been centered in Jenin and particularly in the Jenin refugee camp. So this has been a story that's been happening, but this very deadly raid that the army conducted was kind of the catalyst for us to, it felt like the proper moment to really go in and to, it was definitely a turning point basically. And we felt like it made sense to go in and really talk to people there. Like you mentioned, we talked to a variety of different people, you know, we talked to the families of the victims. So we spoke to the daughter of the woman, Majida Obaid, who was killed. She was just sitting at home reading Quran after her morning prayers when she was shot by a sniper through the window when she was in her house. We interviewed the brother of one of the armed fighters who was killed. We interviewed one of the fighters themselves late at night, you know, in the middle of the alleys in the camp. We interviewed a community leader, an activist. We interviewed the uncle of one of the fighters who was arrested and the homeowner of a home that was completely destroyed during the raid. And like you said, we also interviewed a medic whose teams were there on the scene, treating people or attempting to treat people in the face of, you know, Israeli efforts to push them back and not let them into the camp. So that's kind of, you know, some background information about the documentary itself and who we spoke to and sort of why we spoke to them.
So
when you are educating people that may be new to these issues related to the occupation of, you know, the West Bank and what has happened at the Jenin refugee camp, what do you think the most important points you would make to maybe listeners that are just becoming educated about these subjects?
Sure, that's a good question. I would say that, you know, nothing, as is the case with, you know, I think struggles against oppression all around the world, nothing happens in a vacuum, right? So especially in the West, we're constantly flooded with these images of the Palestinian terrorist, right? So we see a lot of these images of young Palestinian guys, you know, with ski masks on and guns, and they're framed certainly by the Israeli government and by the Western media as well as these nameless, faceless terrorists, right, whose only goal in life is to bring about, you know, the destruction of the state of Israel.
I was going to say that's like the justification that's given for these type of raids by the Israeli government.
Exactly. That's the justification that's given. And it's also the context in which people sort of approach, I say, the general, you know, the general Palestinian struggle as well, in that it's been framed as, you know, Palestinians don't want Israel to exist, rather than looking, you know, at the past 75 years of colonization and oppression and apartheid and occupation. And so when you go into places like the Jenin refugee camp, where you have really young guys, you know, some of them even in their late teens or early 20s, taking up arms to fight against the Israeli army, it's important to understand the context in which they do that. And it's a context of, you know, they are living in these refugee camps that were established 75 years ago. They are now the third and fourth generation of refugees and their family who have, you know, their land was stolen from them. They've been denied the internationally, you know, the enshrined right under international law to return to their homelands. And they've been growing up under abject poverty in crowded refugee camps that are constantly raided by the Israeli government and by the Israeli military. And all of that has culminated in what we're seeing today, which is this younger generation that's kind of thrown their hands up in the air and said, you know, we can't rely. Certainly, you know, the Israeli government, the Israeli occupation is actively oppressing us, and we certainly can't rely on our own Palestinian leaders for help. So we're just going to take things into our own hands. And I think it's really important to give people that context. And it's a side of the story that people are definitely not exposed to, I think, in the mainstream.
I think what we're also often exposed to in the media and sort of discourses around Israel and Palestine, if we're not told, the Israelis have to defend themselves, that's why they have to do these brutal raids, we're often told, these issues are complex. Can you respond to people who try to throw that around? Because I think it misses what's actually happening. I mean, how long has the West Bank been occupied? I mean, this is Palestinian territory that is just continuously occupied. I don't think it's as complex as people make it out to be.
Yeah, I think the sort of argument surrounding, you know, when complexity is sort of thrown in people's faces, I think it's oftentimes it's used just as like a deflective measure to deflect from the fact, you know, the basic facts. When you lay it out all on the table, this year will mark 75 years since the Nakba, or the catastrophe, when the state of Israel was created and when more than 750,000 Palestinians were forced out of their homes and became refugees. Entire communities were massacred, Palestinian towns were wiped off the map. And now you have the Palestinian refugee population that numbers more than 5 million people worldwide. That happened more than 75 years ago. So for 75 years, Palestinians have been living under a continuous state of dispossession, expulsion, settler colonialism, land theft, imprisonment, killing, et cetera, et cetera. the West Bank itself, you asked how long has the West Bank and how long has it been occupied? You know, I think Palestinians would say, you know, since, you know, 75 years ago. The official international sort of date for the occupation of the West Bank is in 1967, after the Six-Day War, when Israel officially occupied the territories that are Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. So even then, you're talking about, you know, more than 50 years of active military occupation on Palestinian land, and the further entrenching of an apartheid system that, you know, infiltrates every aspect of Palestinian life. So yes, there's nuance and complexity in the sense that there are a plethora of different ways that Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism manifests itself in Palestinian lives, but I don't think it's complex when you look at the big picture. And the big picture is that you have, you know, two peoples, two populations living on you know, the same piece of land, but living under the control of a regime and a system and a government that was designed to actively dispossess one of those groups while privileging the other.
And I just wanted to add to that briefly, if I could. I mean, when we talk about the West Bank or Gaza, I mean, this is like an unprecedented occupation. This Israeli occupation has been going on for decades. You know, how long can an occupation go on? I mean, this is permanent at this point. It's just a permanent, continuous occupation. And I think that's unprecedented.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, Palestinians have been sort of saying or almost screaming into the void for so many years, is that how long, not only how long can this occupation and these different systems of oppression continue, but how long can they continue, not just with global silence, but with global complicity and acceptance of the situation, you know, and not just, I wouldn't even say complicity and acceptance, but active participation as well in the oppression of Palestinians.
I want to let Carl ask you a few questions here, but first I wanted to ask, when we talk about armed resistance amongst Palestinians, I think people have this reaction, especially in the West, amongst Western leftists, especially of, you know, I can't support armed resistance. You know, we should always be for nonviolent resistance, you know, the ways of Gandhi. And, you know, I've known Palestinians that have said to me, well, you're not living under an occupation, so you don't get to tell us that. Do you think there is a disconnect in how we think about armed resistance in the West?
I think there's a disconnect in how we think about armed resistance when it comes to who is participating in that resistance. While I, you know, I don't necessarily think that the two are necessarily should be equated, but I think that a recent example that a lot of people give is the comparison between the Russian-Ukraine context and the Palestine-Israel context, right? Where when Russia was invading Ukraine and Ukrainian citizens were taking up arms, I mean, we had the Western media and outlets like CNN profiling Ukrainian civilians having like workshops on how to make Molotov cocktails. And they were being celebrated because, you know, and they were being celebrated as defenders of their country and of their homeland, et cetera. It's kind of, you know, I think a lot of us could agree on why there's such a difference in the treatment of, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white Europeans participating in armed resistance versus a bunch of Muslim Arabs, you know, fighting against the U.S.'s biggest ally in the Middle East. So I think it comes down to the nature of who is participating that resistance when it really comes down to the double standard. Because as, you know, the Russia-Ukraine example showed us, it's not actually difficult for Americans, at least, or for the West to get on board with armed struggle and armed resistance. It just kind of depends on who is doing that. And there's this notion that Palestinians talk about a lot, is that Palestinians are often expected to be the perfect victim, right? And so they must be nonviolent. They must be everything that is acceptable to the West. You know, basically the only acceptable victim when it comes to Palestinians is the ones who, you know, basically die, you know, accept dying while silent. If you speak up, if you rise up, if you take up arms, if you even, you know, as we saw in the case of Ahed Tamimi, if you even slap a soldier that's invading your home, you will be characterized in some way or another as the villain. And so I think that's also important to understanding, like, the way that the West and the media also in general just views Palestinian resistance. It's not just those that are taking up arms that are villainized as terrorists. It's also the kids that throw stones. You know, how many times do we see the justification of the imprisonment of children? Well, it's, oh, they were throwing stones, or the justification of the imprisonment of activists or whatever. Oh, they, you know, they scuffled with Israeli police or soldiers, or they beat some, you know, that sort of thing. And so it's not just even the most nonviolent, you know, protesters or the Palestinians who choose to participate in non-armed struggle are still villainized, imprisoned, and even killed.
I just wanted to add really briefly to that. I've been reading reports recently when it comes to Ukraine. I know some elements of Ukrainian society are saying and reporting that in the Russian occupied territories in Ukraine, that, you know, Russia is now encouraging Russian citizens to become settlers in those occupied territories. And I just commented at one point, I said, that sounds like something another country is doing. In this case, I'm talking about Israel. So I do think there is a disconnect. We don't always talk about the sort of comparisons that can be made between what Russia is doing in Ukraine and what Israel is doing in the Palestinian territories. I think that's important to point out. In terms of the issue of armed resistance, could you talk a little bit about, based on the people you've interviewed, what has driven them to this point? Why is there this feeling that, you know, a political solution is nowhere in sight? And why are these young people, especially these men, resorting to taking up arms?
That's a great question. That is sort of the big question that we were seeking to answer with this documentary. We essentially posed that question to many of the people that we spoke to. We posed that question to the brother of one of the fighters who was killed. We posed it to a community leader, an activist. We posed it to the fighter, one of the fighters themselves who we interviewed. And I'll essentially just quote what we were told, because I think they said it perfectly. When we asked this young man, you know, this young masked fighter who's part of a armed battalion in the Jenin refugee camp, when we asked him, what has driven you to participate in this resistance and to take up arms with the knowledge that you very well could be killed for it? And if you're not going to be killed, you could be imprisoned for the rest of your life. And he said very clearly and plainly, he said that what has caused me to go on this path are my own personal convictions and what I have witnessed in my lifetime. And he described basically what he described was growing up in the Jenin refugee camp. He said, from the time that we were children living in these streets, all we've seen is Israeli violence and oppression, Israeli soldiers raiding our camp, raiding our homes in the middle of the night, every single night, arresting our brothers and fathers, killing our people, abusing our women, scarring our children. We've witnessed that every single day. They talked about, you know, the fighter and also other people we spoke to in the camp, they talked about what the Jenin refugee camp went through during the Second Intifada. So in 2002, when Israel launched the massive invasion into the West Bank, they launched a huge invasion into the Jenin refugee camp, basically leveling almost a quarter of the homes in, you know, hundreds of homes in the camp that left more than a quarter of the population homeless and displaced, and more than 50 Palestinians were killed in that raid during the Second Intifada. And the effects of that raid are very much still felt today. When you go around the camp and when you talk to people, we didn't meet a single person who hadn't been affected in some way or the other by Israel's occupation. So every single house you go into in the camp, there's either someone or multiple people who have been killed from that family, people who have been arrested and have spent years in prison or are still languishing in Israeli prison, whose homes have been destroyed several times by the Israeli military. And so there's this very deep history across Palestine, but specifically in the Jenin refugee camp, of oppression by the Israeli government and the Israeli occupation, but also struggle and confrontation towards that. And to answer your question about the loss of hope, that's something that one of the community leaders told us about. We asked this young guy, sort of this fighter, what drives you? And he said, from what I've seen in my life, when we asked the community leader, who's a member of the older generation, you know, he participated in the resistance during the first and second intifadas. His twin brother was killed by the Israeli occupation. He himself had spent several years in prison. We asked him what's driving this younger generation that, you know, as in his opinion, what's driving them towards this path of armed struggle. And he said, it's simple. Just look at the loss of hope. He said, there's a total loss of hope in the current situation amongst the younger generation, a loss of hope in any sort of political solution. There's no sort of viable solution on the political horizon. The Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leaders have achieved nothing over the past almost 30 years since the Oslo Accords were signed and the PA was created. The Israeli occupation and apartheid have been further entrenched. Israel still controls the borders, the airspace, the sea. It still besieges Gaza. It still raids the camp on a daily basis. And he said these kids have grown up in refugee camps and crowded alleyways in these surroundings for more than 75 years. And they've, you know, it's just been this sort of generational trauma that's been compounding and has now resulted in the situation that we're seeing today. So it's kind of like the perfect storm, right? There's no sort of political horizon for these youth. Their economic prospects are virtually non-existent. And at the same time, they're witnessing oppression on a daily basis. So it's led to the situation we see today where they feel like, okay, you know, maybe going and getting a job with the government or, you know, getting a desk job or even finding a job, that's not even possible for me. How else am I going to enact change?
Yeah, the fighter you mentioned that you interviewed, it really stuck out to me that he said negotiations are going nowhere, basically, and they won't be going anywhere as far as anybody can see, like the Palestinian Authority, and nobody really has any faith in that. And the community organizer or the community leader you spoke to, he said Palestinians are no different from any other people. Any other people put in the same situation would react the exact same way. But something that I found particularly interesting about Jenin is the new political formations that are developing in response to like these endless negotiations and the failure of Palestinian leadership. It's like the Lion's Den or the Jenin Brigade and that kind of thing. And these are particularly interesting because these are groups that are not necessarily too firmly ideological in the ways that like the PFLP or Hamas was, and they seem to be uniting formerly disparate groups of Palestinian society. Can you talk about the new groups that are emerging out of the failure of Oslo?
Yeah, I was going to say real quick before Yumna goes on, I wanted to ask about the Jenin Brigade, because it sounds like it has evolved into something different than maybe what it was initially conceived as. I mean, it was started by the Islamic Jihad movement, but it doesn't seem like it's that today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, the Lion's Den, which is a group that we've covered extensively at Mondo Weiss. They're a group that is based out of Nablus. And you also mentioned the Janine Brigade, which is sort of the focus of this documentary and the people that we spoke to. The Janine Brigade, when comparing it with the Lion's Den, the Janine Brigade is still more closely affiliated with the Islamic Jihad movement. But yes, it was started after the killing of a prominent fighter, a young fighter in the Janine refugee camp in 2021, who had basically, you know, played a pretty big role in the camp of sort of rallying the youth and calling them towards armed struggle. So when he was killed, that rallied a huge population of the younger men in the camp to sort of form this new group. So typically the way that things work, you know, on the ground in Palestine is you have these different political factions from, you know, leftist, you know, Marxist-Leninist groups like the PFLP, and then the more centrist movements like Fatah. And then when you go a little bit more to the religious right, like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, all of those groups, they have their Politburo, and they also have their sort of military wings. And over the years, since all of the establishment of these different groups, they've all participated, those armed and military wings have all participated in armed struggle. What we're seeing now is the formation of groups that are distancing themselves from the traditional political faction model of, you know, fighters and sort of hierarchical structures within, you know, existing armed military wings. So you have groups like the Janine Brigade, who, for example, so they were started by fighters who are affiliated with the Islamic Jihad movement. And it definitely still is very much affiliated with Islamic Jihad. But in the way that it has come to be, the Janine Brigade, when the Israeli army invades the camp and the Janine Brigade calls on its fighters to confront the soldiers and confront the army, it's not just calling on fighters affiliated with Islamic Jihad. All different fighters from different political factions respond to the call. So you have fighters from Hamas, from Fatah, from Islamic Jihad, even from the PFLP, that are participating in armed confrontation together and resisting Israeli invasions into the camp. In places like Nablus, with the establishment of the Lion's Den, now the Lion's Den was established, you know, by, it was established purely as a sort of, not apolitical, but an armed resistance group that is sort of free of the shackles of the traditional like political faction model. So it brought in and it attracted a number of young fighters who were previously affiliated with different movements. So you had fighters from Fatah, you had fighters from PFLP, you had fighters from Islamic Jihad sort of shedding their old titles and coming together under the banner of the Lion's Den and basically preaching this message of, you know, Palestinian unity and cross-factional, this cross-factional model of people joining forces just under the name of, you know, fighting in the name of Palestine versus fighting in the name of different political factions. And that message really has appealed to the younger generation. And I think that's this sort of cross-factional model and messaging that we're seeing is also part of the reason why we are seeing such a resurgence of armed resistance and smaller armed resistance groups cropping up all over the West Bank is because, as we've discussed already, is the younger generation since Oslo has become extremely disillusioned with the Palestinian Authority and with the Palestinian leaders and the political infighting that has been going on for decades between Fatah, Hamas, and the other factions. And the young people are basically, and what we're seeing today, it's essentially this rejection of this old model of, you know, sticking to one political faction and fighting, you know, political infighting, fighting each other for power while, you know, letting Israel further entrench its occupation and apartheid system. So the young people and these new brigades and battalions and different groups are definitely sending the message that we are sort of rejecting these older models and trying to pave a new way forward. And that has certainly appealed to to younger men who want to participate in armed resistance, but it's also appealed, I think, to the Palestinian public as a whole. And we've seen a huge support publicly for these groups as well, even amongst people who themselves are not, you know, maybe they don't participate in armed resistance and are also maybe not necessarily traditionally politically active.
I'm assuming there's going to be some people listening to this that the second they hear Islamic Jihad in relation to the Jenin Brigade, they're going to shut down or be like, why are you even covering this? How do you respond to the people that have that sort of reaction?
I mean, what I'll say is that it's okay to not agree with, you know, different political factions' beliefs, whether it's in Palestine or around the world. What it's important to know is that groups like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, Fatah, basically all Palestinian political factions who at one point or another or are still considered terrorist organizations by the U.S., it's important to know, again, that these groups were only created and only began after the creation of Israel and after decades of Israeli oppression on Palestinian communities. So again, these groups were not created with the goal of, you know, these groups were not created in a vacuum and with the singular goal of, you know, spreading jihad or, you know, driving out Jewish people from the land, et cetera. They were created in a very political context in which their communities and their Palestinian and the Palestinian community had been experiencing dispossession and displacement and oppression for many years. And so they were established as a way to confront that, essentially. So that's sort of the way that I would that I would approach sort of any hesitation when hearing those sort of terms, I think that can maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and if I could add, you know, these are the only groups left since the secular and nationalist resistance groups were completely crushed throughout like the 70s and 80s and 90s. Like these were really the only structures left. It makes sense that people would go to them.
Go ahead.
I know, during the previous war in 2021, I saw it as almost the beginning of a new era, where you saw the people of Gaza, the militants in Gaza, coming up to defend people in the West Bank and Sheikh Jarrah and Jerusalem. It seemed to unite most of the Palestinian political factions. And I think we're entering in a new era here. Is there that feeling on the ground of a period of unity developing?
Yeah, definitely. So just for context, I think for maybe people who aren't familiar with what you're referring to, you're referring to the May 2021 uprisings. People, you know, now refer to it as sort of the unity uprisings. It's when we saw increased, it was in May 2021, when we were seeing increased Israeli violence on communities, like Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, and also attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem and, you know, across the occupied Palestinian territory. That sparked confrontation from armed groups in Gaza who, you know, then started firing rockets towards Israel. And then it turned into another Israeli war on Gaza, basically, that lasted 11 days. And we also saw huge protests erupt in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and most notably even inside Israeli territory as well amongst the Palestinian communities there. And so the reason it was called the Unity Intifada, the Unity Uprisings, is because we did see these sort of, you know, not unprecedented by any means, but certainly, I guess in most recent memory, like this large scale unification of Palestinians across Palestine, despite their geographic fragmentations. And so that gave, and like you said, we saw people in Gaza, standing up and protesting or rising up for people in Jerusalem and in the West Bank and vice versa. And you saw Palestinian communities in 48 and Israel doing the same. And so it definitely, I think, marked a shift. Now we know that eventually those protests kind of did, you know, fizzle out. They didn't really continue or turn into any really big, giant measures of radical change on the ground. But I think it did awaken something in sort of like the Palestinian consciousness, particularly amongst the younger generation who maybe in their lifetime had not witnessed such unity across the land. And so that has definitely, the effects of it, you know, it can't be understated, basically the effects that the 2021 uprisings have had on the moments that we are currently witnessing today. Now, while we didn't in 2021, we didn't see these levels of armed confrontation in the West Bank like we're seeing today. But I think that maybe those messages of unity are definitely spilling over now into what we're witnessing with these cross-factional models in of armed struggle in the West Bank.
Yeah, it's really been one of the few hopeful messages to come out of Palestine in the last, I don't know, 20 years at this point.
I just had a few more brief questions. You know, the other thing I hear when discussions about armed resistance by Palestinians comes up in discourse or conversation is that people will try to argue that, you know, this is what the Itamar Ben-Givers and the Bezalel Smotriches want so that they can have, you know, a bigger crackdown on Palestinians on the West Bank, that they can use this as justification for even more brutality. How do you respond to people who try to sort of make that argument in order to, I guess, argue against armed resistance?
Sure. Well, I mean, to that specific argument, I'll just say that Israel, you know, the current government and previous governments have never really needed justification to, you know, continue or double down on its, you know, a crackdown of Palestinian communities and of Palestinian life in general. And while it certainly, you know, this wave of Palestinian resistance that we're seeing is certainly being used as a political tool as well by the Israeli government, the current government, to, like you said, expand powers of the right wing over the military and of the police, which will then translate to more violence in Palestinian communities. But again, you know, even if that's the case, these armed resistance, you know, groups and this trend of growing armed struggle would not exist in the first place if it wasn't for these, you know, systems of violence and oppression that have been in place long before the current government. So it's kind of like the, you know, people are playing this chicken and the egg type of game first of like, oh, well, what came first? I think it's very clear that we know that, you know, Israeli occupation and apartheid and settler colonialism, the existence of those systems is what has brought about what we're seeing today. And so people could say, oh, well, you know, armed resistance or armed struggle is only going to lead the Israeli government to, you know, oppress Palestinians more. But I mean, they've been doing it for 75 years. So I'm not really sure why they would, you know, they have complete, extreme, full power over everything. And so I don't think they're waiting. I don't think the Israeli government is waiting necessarily for a reason to continue its oppression of Palestinians.
I was just going to add to that. It gets into an interesting point because lately I've been hearing a lot of people say, you know, throwing around this idea that we could be seeing a third intifada. What I don't see a lot of people saying, although I've seen a Newsweek article recently that addressed this, we hear about the third intifada, but we don't hear about the second Nakba. And we're closer to a second Nakba than ever in a lot of ways.
That's an interesting question. I would say go even further than that in saying that many Palestinians, and it's a conversation that's been happening even more recently, would say that the Nakba actually never ended, right? So we refer to the Nakba as the singular event that happened in 1948. But when you look at the foundations of Israel and the foundations of Zionism as a settler colonial project, you can start to see that the Nakba never really ended. While yes, you had this one major wave of mass expulsion that happened in 1948 with the creation of the state, Israel has never stopped its project on the ground and on the land to continue taking over Palestinian land and expelling Palestinian communities. So in Palestine, it's referred to in Arabic as Nakba Mustamirra, which basically means that the Nakba continues, or the ongoing Nakba. And it's what we see in communities like Masafir Yatta, for example, where we are witnessing today the mass expulsion of a community, of an entire community, more than 1,200 people from their land. It would constitute the largest mass expulsion of Palestinians since 1967. We're seeing it in Sheikh Jarrah. We're seeing it in the Jordan Valley. We're even still seeing it in Israel, you know, where Palestinian communities since 1948, where the Israeli government has grown, you know, Jewish community and Jewish communities and Jewish settlements inside Israel, not a single new Palestinian community has been approved. Even, you know, we talk about home demolitions in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but we don't talk about home demolitions that are happening in Palestinian majority cities and towns inside Israel. And so wherever you go, you know, basically between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, wherever you go, you will find that the Zionist project is still very much working to dispossess Palestinians and displace them from their land and replace them with Jewish settlers. And that has never stopped happening since 1948. Yes, we haven't seen a singular event of a mass expulsion, but it's been this ongoing thing that's been happening for 75 years.
So before we close out, Carl, I know you had a question about how Yumna became interested in, you know, Palestinian activism. Do you want to?
Yeah. You know, I came to this interview mainly just wanting to talk to you about your journalism, because I found it very refreshing. And I was doing some research, and I saw that your parents grew up in apartheid Israel, or apartheid South Africa. Sorry. Could you talk about that and like their place in that society and how that informs your current understanding of Palestine?
Yeah, sure. So I come from an originally Indian background. As you know, people know, there's a huge Indian community in South Africa. A very large community that's been around for the better part of a century. And during apartheid, that community, while certainly it did not face the level of oppression that the indigenous Black population faced in South Africa, they were still subject to the discriminatory laws that existed under the South African apartheid regime. And so my family, my extended family, and specifically my parents, were born and raised under South African apartheid. And so, you know, I grew up hearing stories about apartheid in South Africa, what that was like, how it affected my family's lives, how it affected the people around them, how they would maybe participate in different actions and protests to try and, you know, achieve change and bring about the end of apartheid and achieve, you know, equality and justice for all. So those were sort of the themes, I guess you could say, that I grew up hearing about. And so I definitely think, well, maybe at the beginning, subconsciously, it affected, it's just affected my worldview in general. And, you know, having maybe a deeper sympathy for, you know, different struggles around the world and people that are facing oppression and occupation and apartheid in different forms. And so that definitely informed my interest, I would say, in Palestine. I also just happened to grow up in a Muslim American community in the States. I had lots of Palestinian friends growing up when I was in, you know, so I grew up knowing about Palestine and learning about it, but definitely not to to the degree that, you know, I know now, of course. And then, you know, when I was in university, I had the chance to sort of explore that a bit more. And that just continued to really pique my interest in the situation and in the Palestinian cause. And then when I went and visited for the first time, that was sort of marked a huge shift, because, you know, I think a lot of people who have been there will tell you the same thing. Once you actually go to Palestine, and when you go and actually witness for yourself and see for yourself sort of what's going on, it's pretty hard to stay silent. And so I sort of felt compelled, you know, I was studying journalism at the time. I wanted to pursue a career in journalism, and I felt compelled to, in any way that I could maybe play a role in at least bringing Palestinian stories more into the mainstream and bringing forward voices that were not only not being heard, but were being actively suppressed in the media as well.
I just wanted to add that I think we're in a really interesting moment right now when it comes to talking about the struggle of Palestine, right? Because on one hand, I do think there is, a changing tide. There were just polls that came out showing that for the first time, Democrats are more sympathetic to Palestinians than Israel. So it sounds like we're reaching a point where views are changing in the U.S. about these things. At the same time, we have figures like Smotrich openly calling for wiping out the village of Huwara in the West Bank. We're at an extremely dangerous moment. It's very perilous. So I don't know. Are you hopeful or are you pessimistic about where things are headed in the future?
That's always the hardest question to ask. I think that's the question I know that I myself, I get asked a lot. And I know that, you know, other people who are either journalists or involved in the movement on the ground in Palestine get asked the same thing. It's difficult to feel hope in the current situation, you know, when you see the Israeli government and even society growing increasingly, you know, right wing and ultra nationalist. And
yeah, I mean, not to interrupt you, but just I remember last year when the Jerusalem Day marches happened, where you had these right wing Israelis marching through the Muslim corridor yelling death to Arabs. I was just like terrified. It's you see this kind of thing. It's like peering into the heart of darkness. And you know, it sort of makes me feel pessimistic at times. But go on. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's fine. I mean, you're absolutely right. When you see things like that, right, which I think have become so normalized, and not just normalized, you know, in the culture and in Israeli society, but also, you know, in the highest ranks of government. Figures like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich used to be these fringe political figures in Israel, and now they are in the highest ranks of the government. And so, you know, anti-Palestinian violence and sentiment and hatred and the open calls for, you know, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians has become so normalized. And we, you know, we saw that when the U.S., you know, did not go, you know, despite many calls to revoke the visa or to not grant a visa to Smotrich, he was still allowed to travel to the U.S. after his open calls to wipe out an entire Palestinian town. And so it is very frightening and can be very disheartening when you see the degree to which violence against Palestinians has been normalized, not only within Israel, but just on the international stage. That being said, I think in places where maybe people could find hope is in, you know, we cover this a lot on the site as well, is the growing trend of, you know, anti-Zionist voices within the Jewish community in America, and also the growing sort of movement of, you know, Palestine solidarity across the world and specifically in the U.S., where, yes, while violence against Palestinians is certainly becoming more commonplace and more normalized, so is conversations around Palestine. I mean, conversations like the one we've been having today, I don't think would have been possible even just a couple years ago. And so the fact that these conversations are happening, that people are talking about Palestine, the Palestinian voices are, you know, slowly but surely being brought more into the mainstream, and a variety of different Palestinian voices are being heard, I think that can also offer a bit of hope for people who might feel extremely disheartened. So yes, it's dark and frightening times ahead, but and it's certainly on new and unprecedented levels that we, you know, haven't seen before, but it's also nothing that, you know, the Palestinian people certainly haven't been exposed to before in their history, and people haven't stopped fighting for 75 years. So I don't see it, you know, that fight or that desire for liberation or freedom or for change to end anytime soon.
I just wanted to add to that very briefly here. You know, I think it's important too. These figures like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are very frightening figures in my view, but also I think they're very desperate in a way. You know, we're seeing crackdowns even on Jewish activists like Jonathan Pollack, an anti-Zionist activist who was arrested, you know, because he was going against Netanyahu and the Israeli occupation. So I think that shows desperation that, you know, these figures like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir just want to clamp down on any kind of dissent. And it shows they're, you know, they're becoming desperate. Go on, Carl.
Oh, yeah. I was going to come in with a little bit of a different perspective. I'm actually extremely hopeful. Like, you know, you see these guys marching through the streets chanting death to Arabs. That's not a good sign for their political movement. The whole society is unraveling. It's gotten to the point where this violence and like racism is so normalized and amongst the Israeli society that you can't even put these guys on CNN anymore. Are you going to get Smotrich on the BBC? No, you can't. You need to get Anthony Blinken out there to, you know, run cover for these guys. They and it's become such a partisan issue in the US. It's just they can't. It doesn't play well anymore internationally, even in the US. Like, they're coming in with war on terror talking points from like 2004. And I don't think people are buying it anymore. And, you know, I'm very hopeful. I don't think they're getting the play. They're not getting the strong defenses that they would have gotten even 5 years ago. It can only go up from here, I think.
Yeah. And you talked about this desperation that we've been witnessing. And that's also been playing out on the international stage, right? With, you know, the increase in anti-BDS legislation and attempts to get, you know, different governments and societies and groups to adopt the IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism, and this increasing crackdown on any dissenting views that, you know, speak out against Israeli apartheid or disagree with their government's alliances and funding of the Israeli regime. And so the fact that there's this increasing crackdown of any, you know, voices that support Palestine or that are critical of Israel, by whether it's by attempts to paint them as anti-Semitic or et cetera, I think that also is quite revealing of the desperation, not only of, you know, the Israeli regime, but also Israel's partners around the world to sort of maintain the status quo, because I think it's very obvious that things on the ground and public opinion is changing in a way that, you know, we haven't seen before.
I want to let you get going, Yumna, because I know we kept you longer than expected, but there was a portion of the documentary that I felt was really impactful, and I wanted you to speak to it for a moment here. The interview with the paramedic. Could you talk a little bit about that interview and just maybe summarizing it?
Yeah, sure. So we interviewed a paramedic with the Palestinian Red Crescent Emergency Services, and he's based in Jenin and is one of the medics that is always on site when a raid happens in Jenin, and particularly in the Jenin refugee camp. And what he was telling us was that during the course of the raid, Israeli forces prevented him and his crews from entering the camp to treat the wounded. And so Israeli forces, while they were conducting this raid, they sealed off all entrances and exits to the camp, essentially trapping the people inside and preventing medics from going in to treat the wounded. So the man that we spoke to, the medic, his name was Khaled, he told us that You know, the medics could see injured people on the ground bleeding out. And when their ambulances tried to go in to access them, they were shot at, held up by Israeli forces and prevented from going in. And he actually got teary-eyed when we asked him sort of how that made him feel. And he said that, you know, it's sort of this indescribable feeling when you can see people right in front of you and you're not allowed to help them. And he was certain, we asked him, you know, if his crews and other medics who were on site had been able to treat the wounded, did he believe, you know, did he think that the death toll might have been less than what we witnessed, which again turned out to be 10 people? And he said, absolutely. He said, if his crews had been able to access people, they would not have seen the level of death and destruction that they had witnessed that day during the raid. And this is, he also told us, and it didn't make it into the final cut of the documentary, but you know, this is something that they see all the time. It's something that we know from videos and eyewitness testimony. It's something that I myself have reported on many times over the years, is Israeli forces' treatment of Palestinian medics and ambulances. Ambulances are frequently prevented from accessing Palestinian towns and communities that need help. They're held up at checkpoints. Medics are prevented from accessing the wounded. But he told us that it's definitely getting worse under this new government. For some reason, you know, they've noticed a change. Things are definitely getting worse. They're increasingly being prevented access to do their jobs in, you know, grave violation of international law. But again, you know, it's just, I feel like it's just become so normalized. You know, we see these stories all the time of medics being prevented from doing their jobs and from treating the wounded, that often results in people dying, that, you know, people that shouldn't have died end up dying. And so that was, it was a very sobering interview. And it was a difficult one to do, for sure.
Well, I want to thank you again, Yumna, for coming on Parallax Views. Can you let my listeners know how they can watch On the Brink, and also what you hope they get out of this conversation, what you hope they'll get out of watching the documentary?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So just first off, if people would like to watch the documentary and just other coverage, video coverage and video reports that Mondaweiss has done, you can visit our YouTube channel. It's just Mondaweiss, MondoweiSS. It's Mondaweiss on YouTube, and all of our videos are there. You can also visit our website or our social media channels to see different clips that we've cut out from the documentary that are posted on our Instagram. What I hope that people might get from watching the documentary or from this conversation is a different perspective to Palestine, to armed struggle, to what we see on the ground. And that's sort of at the core of our work, is putting forward voices, you know, in front of audiences that otherwise, you know, they would have heard those kinds of voices. So, you know, I don't know where else in the English language media, at least, armed fighters are being interviewed about why they engage in armed struggle, or why they have chosen this path, or what leads people to this path. And so this sort of context of the Jenin refugee camp and of these groups and of these individuals is just really important to understanding not only the current moment, but the past and the future of the Palestinian struggle. And so I encourage people to seek out alternative views and alternative perspectives when, consuming news about Palestine.
Thank you so much. I was very happy to talk to you. This documentary, I think, has hit a new stylistic point on Palestinian documentaries. If Al Jazeera and CNN aren't copying the style to a T by the end of the month, they're messing up, I think.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Please be sure to check out Yumna Patel's work at mondoweiss.net, where you can also find her documentary, On the Brink, Jenin's Rising Resistance. If you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. The first 200 episodes of Parallax Views are now available exclusively to Patreon supporters, $5 tier and above, in a handy master list that you can access as a supporter on Patreon. So keep that in mind if you're looking to help out the show. There is a big perk in doing so. I've been putting a lot of energy into archiving those first 200 episodes, and more will be archived in the coming months. So if you want to listen to some classic Parallax Views, that's the way to do it, folks. So head on over to patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews if you want to help out the show. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.